From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. And this afternoon on Capitol Hill, lawmakers will begin questioning Democratic House managers and the president's lawyers in the Senate impeachment trial. And the question of whether witnesses will testify is still very much up in the air. Joining us now is Senator Dick Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois. He's also the Senate Minority Whip. Senator Durbin, welcome to Here and Now.
Good to be with you.
And this trial moving into an important new stage today, what questions will you be asking?
Well, I have a question prepared. It's based on my work on the Defense Subcommittee of Appropriations and the fact that the administration was notified by the Department of Defense in August that if they did not release the funds for Ukraine's defense, that there was a possible violation of law. And secondly, it wouldn't have been possible to release all the funds within the fiscal year. My question, obviously, to the president's team is, once the president was notified that the money was going to be diminished and there may be a violation of law, why didn't he release it then?
What kind of answer do you expect to hear from the president's team?
I'm not sure, because they've suggested that the president just spontaneously decided to release the funds. It had nothing to do with the phone call with President Zelensky. And that he was determined to help Ukraine. My question raises the point within his own administration where they were warned that further delay in releasing them would diminish the funds that could actually be sent to Ukraine.
There was another development yesterday. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that he does not yet have the votes to block witnesses from testifying. And there are some Republicans who want to hear from former National Security Advisor John Bolton, who says in a book manuscript that the president told him that he held up Ukraine's military aid to try to get that investigation into Joe Biden. Do you believe that by the time the witness vote comes around on Friday that you will have convinced enough Republicans to come along with you on this issue?
There is a glimmer of hope that this just might turn out to be a trial. So far, it's not even close. I used to try cases before I was elected to Congress. We've seen so far, 4 or 5 days of presentation, actually would be an opening statement at a trial. No evidence has been presented. It's been presumed. And people on both sides talked about what the record shows. In a regular trial, that record would have to be presented to a judge or jury and decide whether or not it's admitted into evidence.
But this is not a typical trial. This is a political action more than anything, really. So why do the same rules apply?
Well, the same rules don't apply, but you expect in a trial, and that's what the Constitution calls for, that there will be evidence. Evidence would clearly be documents and witnesses. And I think that started to weigh heavily on the minds of some Republican senators. How will they explain that for the first time in the history of the use of the impeachment clause in the Constitution, there was a so-called trial, but no witnesses showed up?
Now, you have said that you are against a witness swap. In other words, to have John Bolton testify in exchange for Joe Biden. Why is that? Why not?
Well, because this isn't a trading opportunity for members of the Senate and House. As far as I'm concerned, it's a serious matter, the most serious matter under our Constitution. This idea, well, let's bring in Hunter Biden, see if we can spice this up politically. Get down to reality here. The reality is, did that conversation with the president breach his authority in office, and should it result in an impeachment?
I understand you may not like the idea of that swap, but if it means the difference between the American people hearing from John Bolton under oath or not hearing from him, I mean, why not take that risk?
I don't think it's reached that point. It's been suggested by one senator. And let me add, there are 53 Republican senators. So if it's the intent of the Republicans to bring any member of the Biden family before this Senate, they have the votes to do it.
Hmm. We will find out soon whether or not you have the votes to get those witnesses. But there are, in your party, a senator, at least 3 moderate Democrats who might vote eventually to acquit President Trump. You've got Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Doug Jones of Alabama, and Kirsten Sinema in Arizona. You are the whip. It is your job to get those votes together. Are you confident right now that they will vote with Democrats?
Well, I think many of your listeners may be surprised to learn that I have a job with a title that suggests I do a lot of arm twisting. That's the last thing in the world a whip will do in the Senate if
really?
They want to be successful. It just doesn't work, and particularly when it comes to issues of conscience and issues of this magnitude. These individual senators, every individual Democratic senator is on their own. It's a matter of deciding what is best for this country. I hope that we stand together as a caucus, but I respect each and every one of them, whatever their decision may be.
And what would it mean if they vote to acquit? Would it damage the Democrats' message on impeachment?
Well, I think the message is pretty clear as to what the president did and said in that conversation and whether it stepped over some line that most people would agree is inappropriate. Whether it is sufficient to reach the level of impeachment, each senator has to decide.
Quickly, Senator, I know the Iowa caucuses are just less than a week away now on Monday. You have not endorsed yet. Are you willing to do so?
No. I have so many of my colleagues in the Senate running at this point for the presidency and many other qualified people as well. And I'll just tell you that having worked the Iowa caucus for both Paul Simon and Barack Obama, I know it's quite a chore and quite an event. I wish them all well, and I hope we come up with the strongest possible nominee.
Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois and the Senate Democratic Whip, thanks for your time on this very busy day.
Good to be with you.
To Hong Kong now, where the government is taking measures to stop the spread of coronavirus. On mainland China, more than 6,000 people have been diagnosed, and the death toll has risen to more than 130. The government in Hong Kong has now reduced travel to the mainland and urged people to work from home. NPR Global Health and Development reporter Jason Beaubien is there now. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
So we spoke to you on Monday. How has the level of response to the coronavirus changed in Hong Kong in the past couple of days?
It's definitely ramped up. The city is taking very aggressive measures, both to prepare for the potential rise in number of cases, to deal with suspected cases, and to try to keep the virus out of Hong Kong. They've shut down the high-speed rail link to China. They've canceled all the ferry service that goes to the mainland. They've slashed the buses and planes service by about half. And they've even closed down 6 of the 12 border crossing points that go in between Hong Kong and mainland China.
But not all of the ways to get in and out. And why is that?
Well, because Hong Kong is very dependent on mainland China. We actually had this one top health official yesterday, and he was talking about how Hong Kong has to make sure that it still has a food supply. The links between Hong Kong and China are immense, and so shutting down that border would be incredibly disruptive to life here, and so they're not going to do it lightly.
We're seeing scenes of crowded emergency rooms and frantic medical personnel from mainland China. What's the situation at hospitals there in Hong Kong?
Yeah, so Hong Kong is only actually dealing with a handful of actual confirmed cases. Yet the hospitals are already overwhelmed and stressed, and they're setting up new isolation wards. They've got dozens and dozens of suspected cases that show up every day. These people need to be isolated. They need to be tested for the virus. Those tests need to get sent to the lab. Somebody has to analyze them. Staff have to wear these special protective suits just to deal with the waiting room, with the triage people who are trying to screen people. Because the problem is some people just have the common cold, but they can't rule out that they may have this new coronavirus. Mm-hmm. The hospitals, they even set up a lottery system for the nurses to determine who has to work on these isolation wards.
Wow.
And they've put staff on these schedules where they're working 14 days on, and then they're going to get a single day off. So things are really quite tense in the hospitals here, even though we're still dealing with a fairly, you know, small number of actual confirmed cases.
Do you know if Hong Kong is considering setting up a site for quarantining sick people?
They actually have some campsites that they're going to be trying to use as quarantine zones. One other option that they had was a public housing tower. It was a high-rise building, and it had 900 apartments in it, yet the neighbors were so upset about this that they actually torched the building.
Oh,
and
wow.
Carrie Lam, the executive here in charge of Hong Kong, she was just criticizing these people for doing that yesterday. And they have banned people from Hubei province from coming in. And yet there are people here who say it's not enough. So it's a fairly contentious situation between Carrie Lam and the people who are saying that she should be doing more.
I want to ask you about something else. You went to a seafood market in Hong Kong. It's called a wet market because of the fish and other animals. They're alive when they're sold. Researchers think that this virus might have crossed from animals to humans in a wet market in Wuhan. For those who don't know what this wet market is, can you describe it for us?
yeah, it seems like this might have been the place that this coronavirus appeared from in China. So I wanted to go get a sense of, you know, what do these places look like? And it's just a very big, chaotic market. You know, it looks like a large industrial building. It's got tubs of live fish. There's people that are filleting the fish right there. The fish are flopping on the actual counters, and there's chickens in this one. They've got turtles, and these animals are also being slaughtered there. And so they refer to it as a wet market because there's water and there's blood and there's other things on the floor, you know, and they're cleaning it up as it goes. But researchers say you could get an animal virus in a situation where it moves from animals into humans and becomes a new disease. And that's what they believe happened with this coronavirus.
That's NPR's Jason Beaubien in Hong Kong. Jason, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Tanya.
We've been taking a deeper look at where the candidates stand on key issues important to voters. Today, we look at immigration. President Trump ran on the promise of building a U.S.-Mexico border wall, and during his presidency, he has worked to make it harder for many migrants to apply for asylum, among other things. Some of the other top Democratic candidates are promising to reverse his actions. Joining us to talk about what Democrats are pledging to do is Seema Mehta, political writer for the L.A. Times. She's in Iowa ahead of the caucuses. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with the news this week. The Supreme Court allowed a Trump administration plan to go forward that could deny green cards to immigrants who need public assistance. What's been the reaction from 2020 candidates?
We've heard a couple of the candidates speak out about this already. I was at an event with Mayor Pete Buttigieg yesterday, just outside of Des Moines, and he was asked by voters about this specific case. And he started quoting scripture, you know, saying that, you know, the stranger is supposed to be welcome, that this is sort of a core tenet of his faith. And he really spoke out about how, you know, that this was sort of unconscionable. We've also heard Elizabeth Warren. She tweeted about this. And more broadly, I mean, if you look at what the candidates have said about immigration and about the Trump administration's policy, this is an area where you're going to see a lot of agreement. I mean, there's not a lot of daylight. In other immigration policy, there are differences here and there. In terms of, you know, sort of cutting down access, you know, for people who are in the country illegally, who are seeking documentation, this is an area where you're going to see broad agreement among the Democratic candidates.
Let's talk about some of those other big questions on immigration. Mm-hmm. What are candidates saying about President Trump's push to build this wall along the U.S. border? Right. There are already some structures that are up. What would Democrats do?
And most of them are completely against the wall. Some of them have, though, if you look at their past, some of them have, in, you know, some of the members who have been in the Senate, for example, in the past have occasionally voted for border funding. And some of them late last year, when there was discussion about DACA, you know, the young people who were brought into this country illegally when they were very young. Some of them said that they were amenable to some compromise. Like if you grant these young people citizenship, they might do a little bit of border funding. But largely, I mean, they're pretty much in lockstep in opposing the president's policies. They talk about several of them, Senator Klobuchar. They talk about, you know, in the first 100 days, you know, using any type of executive action they could to undo many of the president's policies. The areas where you see some distinction is whether, you know, the crossing the border illegally, whether it should remain a crime or whether that should be, you know, a civil offense. Yeah. For example, Senator Klobuchar, she would keep it a crime. Other people like Bernie Sanders would decriminalize that.
Decriminalizing illegal border crossings, that's something that former Vice President Joe Biden does not support. Here he is at a debate this summer.
We're in a circumstance where if, in fact, you say you can just cross the border, what do you say to all those people around the world who, in fact, want the same thing to come to the United States and make their case, but they don't, that they have to wait in line? The fact of the matter is you should be able to. If you cross the border illegally, you should be able to be sent back. It's a crime.
This is an interesting topic in that it's been shown that Americans do want some sort of reform. They perhaps want some sort of change at the border crossings. But exactly what they want is still up for question, and whether these candidates really address what the public wants.
Well, I think the former vice president is really in an interesting spot because he's faced a lot of criticism from activists throughout this campaign because, you know, he was part of the Obama administration. Deportations rose to record levels during the Obama administration. Some Latino activists called President Obama the deporter in chief. So he's faced a lot of scrutiny on that, on the campaign trail. I mean, I think you're exactly right. I mean, I think if there's anything that people in both parties agree on, it's that the immigration system is incredibly broken, the way it currently exists. They obviously differ very much in how they would fix it.
I want to talk to you about ICE. It's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which, of course, is responsible for deportations. Bernie Sanders has called for the breaking up of ICE. Elizabeth Warren has called for the remaking of ICE. How big of an issue is this? What are candidates saying?
Well, this is an area where you actually can see some differences among the candidates in the field. I was at a Bernie Sanders rally on Saturday in Ames, and he was with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And when she brought this up as a huge point, and this was very, very popular with the crowd, that, you know, once you have children in cages at the border, once you have babies being ripped from their mother's arms at the border, that there is no reforming ICE, that it needs to be abolished. Other candidates would take a more measured approach. For example, former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, he sort of leans on his McKinsey background here in that he wants to study it and figure out what to do with ICE, but he's not calling for abolishing it. Elizabeth Warren's another one. So this is an area where there is a little bit of daylight between the candidates.
Another issue that many Democrats are bringing up is increasing aid to Central American countries, where migrants, of course, are coming from. Here's Senator Warren in a September debate.
Why do we have a crisis at the border? In no small part because we have withdrawn help from people in Central America who are suffering. We need to restore that help. We need to help establish and reestablish the rule of law so that people don't feel like they have to flee for their lives.
A number of candidates are also promising to protect so-called dreamers. Those are people who were brought to the country illegally as children. Here's Senator Bernie Sanders at a San Diego rally in December.
We will restore the legal status to the 1.8 million young people and their parents eligible for the DACA program.
What have some of the other candidates, Democratic candidates, said about DACA? Buttigieg, Klobuchar, some of those others.
I mean, this is an area where there's broad agreement that something has to be done for these young people. I mean, they all talk about, you know, this being one of their top priorities to, you know, if they're elected to do this as soon as they get into office, to take steps to protect these people. Some of them also talk about expanding it. For example, Sanders, who you just played, he would expand it to their parents. Klobuchar would raise the age for which people were eligible, which would also increase the number of pool of people who could apply.
Yeah. You know, when we talk about this issue of immigration, we're often talking about coastal areas. But former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg has spoken about what immigration can do for rural areas. Let's listen.
Part of my plan for revitalizing the economies of rural America includes community renewal visas that would allow cities and towns and counties that are hurting not only for jobs but for population to embrace immigration as we have in my city. You know, the only reason that South Bend is growing right now, after years of shrinking, is immigration.
That's an interesting take. Mm-hmm. Have other candidates talked about this, about spurring the economies and other parts of the country through immigration?
Former Vice President Biden, he's proposed allowing local governments to petition for new immigration visas to support economic growth if there aren't enough local workers to fill jobs. So that's sort of a new proposal we're hearing this cycle that I don't think we've heard before. And it's interesting. I mean, being in Iowa, Iowa's obviously an incredibly homogenous state. It's more than 90% white. But there are certain pockets of, you know, when you get outside of the metro areas, there are these rural areas where the young people are leaving and they need workers. And you do see some areas that have, you know, that have an increase in Latino workers. I think it started out, you know, long ago with the slaughterhouses, et cetera, but it's certainly expanded since then. So I think it's an interesting area where people, you know, are talking about, you know, where there just simply aren't enough American workers to fill the needs of a community.
You're in Iowa, as you mm-hmm. just mentioned. Has that been a topic of conversation about those immigrant populations in Iowa, how they make up Iowa, and maybe how some of the candidates are trying to reach them?
I mean, immigration has come up on the campaign trail, but it hasn't come up as much as some other issues just because I think because there is such broad agreement among the Democratic candidates, among the field, about these proposals and about, you know, what the right thing is to do with people who are in the country illegally. On the Republican side, which I've covered here in past cycles, it has been much more of a flashpoint in terms of what should happen to them.
We talked about this a little bit, but presidents on both parties have failed to tackle comprehensive immigration reform for years. I mean, this has been an issue. If a Democrat is elected, what do you think the chances are that they'll actually have success?
I think it would depend on the makeup of the Senate. I mean, there are some policy areas where if you look at the polling, there's pretty broad agreement among Americans about what should happen in terms of, you know, for people who have been in this country for decades who, who have not committed crimes, who have worked, who have paid into the system. There's a question about, do they become citizens or do they, become legal residents? But there is sort of agreement that, that we're not kicking out 11 million people. But the question is, once, we saw this under George W. Bush, we saw this under President Obama, I mean, once it gets caught up in Congress and, in the Senate, it keeps stalling, even when there does seem to be a chance of reaching agreement. So I think it really depends on the makeup of the Senate.
Seema Mehta is a political writer for the LA Times. She's in Iowa right now for the Iowa caucuses. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And there's a lot more information on the candidates' plans online. Senator Elizabeth Warren, for instance, is calling for ending unnecessary detention of immigrants. She wants to parole some of who have immigration cases pending in the U.S. who don't pose a flight or safety risk. Former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, like other candidates, supports a pathway to citizenship for the 11 million estimated undocumented immigrants in the U.S. Bloomberg told the San Diego Union-Tribune that the U.S. needs to improve border security while increasing aid to the countries where migrants are fleeing. Andrew Yang would expand the number of highly skilled immigrants allowed in the U.S. His website says, quote, any highly rated worker or graduating student who receives a graduate degree here should be given a green card to remain in this country as a permanent resident. First, there was Stoptober for smoking, an attempt to get people to stop smoking for a month. Then we saw Dry January, a bid to get people to be booze-free for a month. Veganuary is now the latest campaign to get people to cut out animal products this month. Hundreds of thousands of people around the world signed an online pledge to go vegan for a time, and many are actually following through with it. A market research firm that looked at grocery receipts estimates more than 1 million people in the UK alone may be participating. Sophie Eastaw reports from London.
It's Monday lunchtime at Cook Daily, a buzzing eatery beneath a railway arch in East London, where the menu is 100% vegan.
I ordered the jerk bowl with vegan chicken, and it's absolutely delicious.
Alex Lazar is a 34-year-old management consultant who lives nearby. He used to eat meat or dairy in every meal, but he's taken up veganuary largely because he's worried about climate change.
The more rainforest that we're demolishing in favour of pasture is doing a huge amount of damage to biodiversity, and it's also unsustainable.
Alex won't go full vegan, but he says that after this experience, he's committed.
Even if we have to make changes that are difficult for us, we have to, if we want the planet to be in a state for our children and our children's children.
In fact, the British government's advisory panel on climate change is recommending that people cut the amount of meat and dairy they eat by a fifth.
Hello,
nice to meet you.
Me too.
I'm Sophie.
Southeast of London in Kent, Carly Edwards Day, a tutor, has taken up the challenge with her husband Graham, a prison officer. Carly's cooking 3 bean enchiladas for dinner with the help of her 7-year-old daughter Libby as Graham gives their 1-year-old Lottie a bath.
If you'd have told me last January that I was ever going to try this, I would have laughed at you.
But something happened.
I had a stroke about a year and a half ago when I was pregnant with Lottie, so I was only 36 at the time. I've got my whole left side of my face, mouth, arm and hands are completely numb.
Carly's intensely aware of her brush with death, and she's read that a plant-based diet has been linked to a reduced risk of stroke and heart disease. She'll stay largely vegan going forward.
You know, I've got children. I want to be as healthy as I can.
Carly's still giving her kids the option of eating animal products. I asked Libby what she thinks of vegan sausages.
Tell the truth.
I actually hate them.
So does Abby Reader in South Wales.
I should be glad to see the back of Veganuary. As soon as we hit the 1st of February, I'll be celebrating.
Abby farms beef and dairy. She says people don't need to go vegan to save the planet.
The agricultural industry here in the UK has an aspiration to be carbon neutral by 2040. It's going to be met by improving productivity on farms. It's also about looking at more renewable energy, planting trees where it's appropriate to plant trees.
While the war on words between farmers and vegans may simmer down come February, the explosion of plant-based alternatives in British shops and restaurant chains suggests this trend will only grow. This is the BBC's Sophie Eastaw reporting for NPR News in London.
The United Nations warned today that the world must be on alert as the new coronavirus spreads beyond China. 15 countries have confirmed cases of the virus, bringing the total number worldwide to more than 6,100. Mostly all of them are in China, and just over 130 people have died. 5 cases have been confirmed in the U.S., and though the risk to Americans remains low, emergency rooms are on high alert. They're putting measures into place to avoid the spread of the disease. Julian McGreevy is the medical director of the emergency department at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. Dr. McGreevy, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
And we understand you've had a pretty hectic week because you've had some suspected cases of coronavirus come through the emergency department. Tell me what you've seen.
Correct. So suspected cases, nothing confirmed. We see people who are coming in with flu-like illnesses and who have a travel history to China. And so our standard procedure in those cases is to give those people a mask, put them in what we call an airborne isolation room, and go through the history to try to figure out how high risk they are, working with both our infection prevention teams and the State Department of Health.
What is an airborne isolation room? Do you just have those around the emergency department?
So we do. Every emergency department has these. They are special rooms designed to prevent any kind of tiny particles in the air from leaving that room and going to other parts of the emergency department. So they're a negative pressure room, negative air pressure relative to the spaces around them. The air is exchanged and filtered. And so if you have somebody who is at risk for having some sort of what we call airborne illness, you would put them in that room for screening and evaluation.
What are doctors and nurses actually wearing? Are they wearing protective suits and masks?
They are. So everybody who comes in contact with us, with patients, is wearing protective equipment. We actually wear a number of items. So you have the usual gloves. We also add a gown for what we call contact precautions, as well as a special kind of respirator mask called an N95 mask. So this is a mask that catches very small particles. So that's really the important mask you need. And then we wear on top of that a face shield. So really there's 4 layers of protection for caregivers for these patients.
Do the doctors feel like they are adequately protected? Are people concerned about their own health?
Yeah, I think naturally people are. You know, there's varying levels of degree of concern, but on the whole, people drill this and practice this and are used to wearing this kind of equipment and have standard procedures. So overall, I would say that the confidence is really high that people feel safe and protected when they care for these patients.
How do you test these patients and confirm that it's coronavirus or not something just like the flu?
We actually do start by testing them for the flu because odds are it is something like the flu or one of the other cold viruses. If at the end of the day those things are negative, we have a high enough suspicion based on their symptoms and their travel history to China, then ultimately that test can be sent to the CDC. So the only test that can be performed for this novel coronavirus is at the CDC.
Is it a blood test?
It is a respiratory secretion test.
So you send that sample off to the CDC. But then what? What do you do with the patient while you wait for the test results?
So at the moment, we actually have not sent our samples to the CDC. So in collaboration with the Department of Health, our infection prevention folks, talking to the CDC, they have felt that the patients didn't need to be tested for this virus. So while they had some symptoms somewhat concerning and some travel history, ultimately they were low enough risk that they could return home and be cared for there.
But you'd have to prepare for that situation to change, that eventually you will get one of these patients and you will need to send that test off.
Certainly. So those patients still may end up going home depending on the CDC recommendation, because that may actually be the safest thing to do rather than having them stay in the hospital exposed to other patients. But again, that'll be sort of a CDC and a State Department of Health recommendation.
Sure. How does what you're doing in New York and what other U.S. hospitals are doing across the country, and I assume they're doing something similar, how does that compare to what's being done in China? Are there major differences between emergency departments here and there?
You know, overall, we really have the ability to fully screen people, mask them, get them into the right kind of isolation room. I don't know for sure, but I think with the volume and concern in China, it would be much harder to do all those procedures.
So far, there have been nearly 6,000 diagnosed cases of coronavirus around the world. But by comparison, there's been 8,000 flu deaths already this year in the United States alone. And last year, there were 61,000 flu deaths in this country. Do you think that this much concern around the coronavirus is justified? Are we over-preparing?
So I don't think you can be over-prepared. I think it's justified in the sense that this virus is new, and so we just don't know. And so it makes sense for people to be vigilant. I do agree that really the primary thing that people should be thinking about this season is flu, your risk of getting flu and having some sort of severe or adverse outcome related to it is much higher. So it's really important that people get vaccinated and then follow really all the same kind of precautions for both viruses, flu and the coronavirus, which is, you know, covering your mouth when you cough and really good hand hygiene, warm water, 20 seconds.
That's Dr. Jolien McGreevy. He's medical director of the emergency department at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. Dr. McGreevy, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Another science story we're following is happening later tonight in outer space, 560 miles above Pittsburgh. Two satellites are on course to pass within a few hundred feet of each other, and there's a pretty decent chance they will collide. The debris are an idled NASA telescope from the 1980s and an old U.S. Air Force satellite first launched in 1967. The space debris tracking company LEO Labs said today that there is a 1 in 20 chance of a crash. For more, we're joined by Brian Whedon. He's with the Secure World Foundation, and he studies space debris. Brian, welcome.
Glad to be here.
These are big satellites traveling very fast, 9 miles per second. What happens if they do collide?
Well, nothing good. You know, in the short term, essentially, the two satellites would disintegrate into thousands and thousands of tiny pieces. Unlike, let's say, a car wreck, where they would come to a halt, they're still going to keep going largely on their original trajectory with original velocity. So you're going to see, you know, two objects that were going around the Earth in separate circles are suddenly going to become thousands of objects going around the Earth in separate circles. And over time, all those new objects are going to kind of spread out and then sort of become almost a background radiation hazard.
I want to ask you about that in just a minute. But first of all, I mean, like, if that explosion does happen, do people on the ground in Pittsburgh see it? I mean, could any of the debris rain down on Earth?
So it's going to happen at about 600 miles above the Earth. And at that altitude, debris takes usually years to a couple of decades to come back into the atmosphere. So no, people are not going to, you know, there's no risk to the Earth immediately from this collision. And it's not really an explosion in that you're not going to see a fireball in space because there's no oxygen for that to happen. It's small enough that it's very unlikely they would see anything that would kind of happen.
Well, we know that space junk is a growing problem. There's a lot of stuff orbiting around the Earth. Some countries like China and India have even blown up their own satellites in space. I mean, what kind of risk is this, big picture, to space travel?
So there are, at the moment, roughly 2,200 functional satellites orbiting the Earth, and they're joined by about 25,000 pieces of debris bigger than a softball, some the size of buses. And that's all kind of the result of our activities in space the last 50 years. If, you know, for any given satellite, the risk is not that high. It's maybe a few percent per year. But over the entire population of satellites, that's a lot. And the challenge is that it's going to make all that debris is going to make orbiting in space and operating satellites more costly, more risky. And sometimes we may not be able to, you know, afford that. So we might lose critical services like weather forecast data or some communications data.
So is there any way to sweep it up, get rid of it? I mean, it's moving so fast. A job like that seems very dangerous. Are there any solutions?
Well, there's, you know, quite a bit of discussion over the last 20 years about the technology to remove these kinds of dead objects. There are a few companies out there that are actually working on this. The technology is difficult, but it's not the really hard part. The really hard part is who pays for it. A lot of these satellites and dead debris are left over from government missions that happened decades ago. And there's not a lot of interest from governments in paying more money to go up and remove all this stuff. So at the moment, that's really the biggest challenge.
That's Brian Whedon with the Secure World Foundation talking to us about the possibility that two large satellites in space could collide over Pittsburgh this evening. Thanks for your time, Brian.
Welcome.
Every day, there's a swirl of new developments from the impeachment trial. And even if you're one of those who spend hours watching it, it can be hard to make sense of everything going on. So we wanted to answer some of your questions. And to do that, we've brought in NPR's senior editor and correspondent, Ron Elving. Welcome, Ron.
Good to be with you.
Well, thanks for being here. We know there are so many rules that govern the trial. For example, senators are not supposed to talk during the impeachment trial, but they can speak to the press during breaks. We got a lot of questions about senators' behavior. Our first question comes from Karen Johnson, who asks, why are senators not being admonished for leaving the room, reading books, talking to each other, and giving interviews when they are supposed to be listening to the prosecutors?
The simple answer is because Chief Justice John Roberts doesn't feel like playing the role of, if you will, schoolmarm and telling them all to get back to their seats. The discipline must be imposed by the presiding officer. There's really no one else to do it. And he does not seem to be inclined to do it. The behavior has actually gotten better because people have gotten more interested in sitting down and listening to what was being said. But there has been a lot of breach of the rules that you describe.
Speaking of Chief Justice John Roberts and his role, we also received quite a few questions about that. Corey Thurlow asks, can Justice Roberts compel the White House to comply with subpoenas for documents and or witnesses?
That would involve the court, not just John Roberts. He could not, as the presiding officer in this trial, simply declare that the subpoenas that might have been issued earlier by the House or any subpoenas that might be issued now had to be honored by the president. Generally speaking, it would not begin at the Supreme Court level. It would begin at a district court level, then go to an appeals court. It would take weeks, months before that was ruled on. It's not inconceivable that the court could move faster, but we have seen very little inclination on the part of this court to move at the speed of impeachment.
This next question comes to us from Danielle Herrera. Let's listen.
My name is Danielle Herrera, and I'm from Boston. My question is in regards to the 2020 presidential election. If President Trump is impeached, would the acting president, Mike Pence, automatically be entered as a Republican presidential candidate? If not, is there enough time for another Republican candidate to campaign before the election?
Ron.
Mike Pence, I think, would be automatically interested in being the nominee, but that does not make him the nominee, and there would have to be a process. And if Mike Pence wanted to be president, there would probably be some other Senate Republicans, gubernatorial Republicans, who would want to run as well.
As you know, Ron, President Trump tweets a lot. In fact, that's probably an understatement to say he tweets a lot. Aaron of California wants to know how much control Senate Republicans have on Trump's tweets. Here's his question. Trump has implied that his tweets are legal and binding by his response required of the Wars Power Act via tweet. Can Congress use his tweets as legal and binding as part of the impeachment since he considers them legal and binding?
Yes, they have been declared in essence to be official White House statements. So if he says or does something with his Twitter account that would seem to be obstructing Congress or ultimately in perhaps another proceeding obstructing justice, which he is not accused of in this impeachment trial, and that doesn't happen to be a piece of evidence that the Democrats are using particularly in this particular proceeding.
This next question is in regards to how impeachment works, if there are enough votes. Let's listen.
My name is Bobby Lynn Hutchins. I'm from Bar Harbor, Maine. And my question is, if there were enough votes to remove Trump from office, how does that procedure work? How long would it take? And what would happen if Trump refused to leave?
We're in somewhat uncharted waters here because no president has ever been compelled to leave. And in the cases of the two other impeachment processes that we've seen, Nixon voluntarily resigned before he was impeached and removed. In the case back in the 1860s and again with Bill Clinton, the Senate chose not to remove the president. We don't really have any guidelines here. One assumes that the judgment of the Senate would be enforced by the Supreme Court, and at that point, the president would no longer have the authority to be president or call himself president. Someone else would, Mike Pence would, and legal authorities would follow his word rather than Donald Trump's.
You know, this next question from Chelsea from Massachusetts, I think it's the question that lots of Americans want to know as they watch. She wants to know the likelihood based on the makeup of the Senate of removing Trump from office.
It's simply not likely. We are debating at this moment whether there would be a handful of Republicans, four at minimum, maybe a half a dozen, who would be willing to vote for a rule allowing for witnesses. And so that's a question mark, whether there would be four. If the Senate Republicans were going to vote to remove the president, there would need to be 20 of them. Mm. And at this point, there's no indication that we're anywhere near that number, or even for that matter, single digits. So it's a long, long step from where we are now to 20 Republicans being willing to vote to remove the president from office.
That's NPR's Ron Elving. Ron, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd, and you're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. We'll broadcast from Iowa, where the caucuses are just days away. We'll hear from voters, experts, and also from former candidate and DNC chair Howard Dean. He made all the headlines on the night of the Democratic caucuses in 2004.
The most headlines of anybody that ever came in third.
Right. We'll broadcast from Iowa next time on Here and Now.